Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, September 23rd, day 6 of our fall membership campaign. This morning, we hear from the former principal of Damien Memorial School, who filed a whistleblower suit over his removal and who settled a complaint this month. We consider the dwindling enrollment numbers at Hawaii's public schools, and we hear from a Big Island charter school that is looking to expand. And This American Life, we Hana Hoan interview that we had with host Ira Glass about a Hawaiian vacation that he took with his family decades ago. It became a segment on This American Life. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A whistleblower lawsuit filed by the former principal of Damien Memorial School has been settled. Arnold Lanui Jr. is a retired FBI agent and a proud graduate of the school. He has been a guest on this show before. We first talked to him when he was named school administrator, bringing his law enforcement background and experience working in the Hawaii Department of Education, and then when he lost that job. He then filed a lawsuit against the school, alleging wrongful termination and retaliation.
Filing a lawsuit against the institution I absolutely love was one of the most difficult decisions I've ever had to make. But sometimes protecting the organization and ultimately protecting the people that organization serves requires some uncomfortable conversations and some facing of some hard truths. And over the course of, I guess, all of my careers, whether it be my 25-year career as a FBI special agent and in federal law enforcement, or in the years I've had working in the DOE or in private education over at Damien, I've seen what happens when folks lose their way, when they lose their moral compass. I'm very grateful that this isn't the first tough storm I've been through, but it is a storm that tested that moral compass, and I'm happy to report that moral compass works just fine.
You had shared that filing this whistleblower suit really opened your eyes to a lot of things, including a signing or not signing a non-disclosure or non-defamation clause. But yeah, what else would you like to share with our listeners about this experience?
Just looking at whistleblower suits in general, I really learned a lot. I come from a heavy background in criminal law, especially in federal criminal law. But I had never really been a part of a civil suit, much less having to serve as a defendant or as a plaintiff in a civil case. And in my case, I brought forth a whistleblower allegation, which is basically an allegation where I was wrongfully terminated from my position as the CEO and president of Damien when I brought up some serious issues, basically some very serious allegations surrounding our football program that included a sex scandal, that included a fraudulent invoice, that included an illegal recruitment scheme that violated ILH rules and state and federal tax laws. These are serious allegations that I was bringing forward, and I had felt that I had been wrongfully dismissed and terminated because of it. But ultimately, when you look at whistleblower suits, they're not about revealing scandals. They're about revealing the systems that tolerate those scandals. And that was something I had to face head on. Hawaii has a really unique and very pervasive form of corruption. Randy Roth, my former law professor and the author of a well-known book here in the islands, Broken Trust, correctly identified Hawaii's corruption as deliberate indifference. Basically, that situation when people look the other way. The willful blindness, the intentional ignorance, the going along to get along is what enables and facilitates and protects wrongdoers. And it's only by standing up and actually taking an active stand against that type of stuff that we can undermine that unique form of Hawaii corruption.
I know during these difficult times for private and public schools, we are seeing enrollments drop just because there aren't enough kids out there. And I often wonder when a school has challenges recruiting. I mean, Damien took the bold move of allowing girls into the school. And I don't know, as an educator, how are you looking at that? Because we are seeing more schools go that route just because they're trying to survive, whether it be St. Andrews that's going to do this next year. Iolani School did that many decades ago. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, certainly private institutions have got to make some moves in order to survive in what the reality of Hawaii economics is all about. You know, I had taken some time to study, actually at length, the kind of situation that's facing a lot of our schools here. And you mentioned the very first one, which is a shrinking demographic. When you have less kids, you have less enrollment. And when you have less enrollment, your primary lever for revenue disappears. By the same token, as those kids grow up and then they move away to the mainland, your second lever for school success disappears, which is your alumni base. That's the base that you use to kind of raise money to help support the school, the institution itself. But when those two primary levers, when enrollment drops and when the market economy then gets a little bit more constrained and donations dropped, it makes it difficult. And in order to survive, schools have got to come up with something different. They've got to redefine what their niche is. And Damien isn't the first one, as you mentioned, to go from same gender to a co-ed education model. But even before that, Damien expanded its enrollment. Back in my day, it was Damien Memorial High School, but now it's Damien Memorial School as it's expanded to include a middle school. And you'll see schools do things along those lines. Sometimes it's a curricular development program, like Sacred Hearts has a stellar science program that includes a well-known program called Girls Who Code. They've done a really good job in trying to define a top-notch female education system that focuses on science. But they've also expanded to, they've included the arts and a lot of creative type drama and dance as part of their curricula as well. St. Louis has obviously a storied football program, which seems to be doing very well. But of course, when you only go with one gender, you've cut your enrollment possibilities in half. So certainly every institution, whether it's a same gender school, whether it's a co-ed school, whether it's a country school or a big city school here on Honolulu, everybody's struggling to find kids to enroll.
I just remember there were mergers too, right? I think Epiphany partnered with MidPack with the younger grades. And so you're just looking at different ways to survive because as the enrollment gets thinner and thinner, you got to make some hard choices.
Yeah, and that's another model that works out. When it's done well, I affectionately call it the Claremont McKenna model. You've seen this model like up in California where a coalition of five small colleges and universities all pooled their resources, Pomona, Harvey Mudd, Sarah Lawrence. These institutions all created a top-notch educational system because they can share some resources. I would not be surprised to see that type of collaboration increasingly more here in Hawaii. That would most likely be a way of trying to save some costs by load bearing. You share the cost of administration, you share the cost of infrastructure amongst other schools when your enrollment shrinks in order to stay alive.
I know that no school facing those challenges needs bad press, and certainly this was a cloud over your alma mater, but I know you care very much about Damien.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the reputational hit, obviously, for any institution is a hard one. But once again, in situations like that, acknowledging what those wrongdoings are and making amends and explaining openly how you're planning on moving forward and how those corrections are in place and what that timeline is for future success, I think that's something that anybody who's facing reputational damage has got to engage in. Any institution that's facing those challenges, that would be my recommendation on what they should do.
And we all know what a sacrifice it is to put your child in a private school because it is expensive.
Right.
But I think as consumers, right, parents need then to ask maybe some uncomfortable questions when their school is in the headlines, or they want to know what are they going to get for their money. Are they going to get the proper upbringing and modeling that they want for their child?
Right. Yeah, ultimately, what I have always felt as a parent who with three kids who found a way through private education, what I always felt was, hey, if I'm investing my hard-earned cash into this institution, is it going to accelerate my child's ability to move forward to a top-notch university and then find a way into a workforce? Now, this is going to rub some people the right way and some people the wrong way. But over the course of my career in education, which not only existed after my time in the Bureau, but I had been working alongside schools for many years all over the world, going back into the early 1900s, but in the early 2000s. But my experience has always been that the determining factor for a child's success isn't necessarily where you go to school. It's what you got at home. If you've got top caliber parents or grandparents or at least one very strong positive advocate for that child, and by advocate, I not only mean somebody who's going to be in the corner for that kid cheering them on, but more importantly, telling them what not to do, disciplining that individual, that has by far been the only guarantee I've seen for a kid's success, because I've worked in both public and in private education, and I've seen kids do well in both. But the only factor that was common between each of them was what they got at home. Did they have somebody who that was a strong advocate that was in their corner providing discipline and guidance for a very long period of time? And you don't need even both parents. You just need one. If you got more than one advocate, even better. You have a safety net now. But if you've got at least one person backing you, your route to success is significantly higher than somebody who does not have that.
And we did reach out to Damien School for comment on the settlement with Lanui. We did have some follow-up questions about what might have changed since the lawsuit, and the school said it was declining comment at this time. This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat's education reporter Megan Togami joins us to talk about her story. Good morning, Megan.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, and so you worked on this story with Jessica Terrell, and I really appreciated looking at the hard data, you know, where the enrollment has dropped at some of our schools.
Right. You know, statewide, we've been seeing a drop in public school enrollment for almost more than a decade now, since the 2013-2014 school year. But as we mentioned in our story, the enrollment drops really haven't been equal across the state. There's a few areas of the state, like Ewa and Kapolei and Central Maui, where there's a lot of housing development and actually some projected growth in the area, but then also some communities, especially in areas where the population is a little bit older and maybe just naturally shrinking, that the enrollment has taken some really big hits in recent years.
Yeah, I know that. You know, one notable fact, you say Honohuli'uli Middle School grew by 345% in the 5 years since it opened, you know. But, yeah, it's uneven when you look at schools where the enrollment has really dropped very low.
Right. Definitely. And especially this is coming at a time when the Board of Education has at least begun to talk in recent months about the possibility of closing schools. And it sounds like they're not there quite yet, but it's definitely something that's on people's minds and something people feel very strongly about, of course.
Well, you know, I know in my neighborhood, Queen Liliuokalani School, you know, that's right across from Civil Beat's headquarters. And
right.
That school closed down because of dwindling enrollment. And, you know, it's now being used by DOE for its administrative offices.
Right. And I think that's a lot of the discussion right now is, you know, the department hasn't closed a school since 2011. And there's a lot of debate about if the department closed down schools, what would that look like? What would that mean for families? What would it mean to possibly repurpose these schools for offices or other uses? But the department most recently at the Board of Education meeting said that before they consider closing schools, they're going to look at redistricting first to see if they can, you know, kind of even out the student populations in some communities and make sure that, you know, schools are being used to the best of their abilities.
Yeah, but some of that is going to be easier in some areas and harder in others, right?
Right. I mean, some people have pointed out that, you know, it's on Oahu at least, urban Honolulu is kind of seeing a lot of declining student populations, and then it's out in Ewa and Kapolei that are seeing growing student populations. So in those cases, when growth is so concentrated in one area, it's a lot of people have said it's just not realistic to expect, you know, to bus kids from Ewa and Kapolei into Kaimuki, for example.
Well,
or something like that.
Yeah, and I know, you know, you've been tracking, you know, these meetings where they've been talking about this issue, but has anything come up at all about charter schools? I mean, you know, we do have, I think, Wailea Elementary, right, that's a charter school, but there are
right.
other places that, you know, I'm thinking University Lab School is one where they're going to lose their campus eventually. But, yeah, I mean, how can the charter schools factor into this?
Right. There hasn't been a lot of discussion so far, although, like you said, facilities have been an ongoing challenge for charter schools, and a lot of them are searching for, you know, new facilities or permanent facilities. I know charter schools have also seen some enrollment growth in recent years compared to the DOE, which is interesting. But, yeah, there hasn't been a lot of discussion so far about how charter school charter schools could possibly use DOE campuses if they were to close down the line.
Yeah, I mean, so many, you know, issues as we face the reality of just fewer kids out there and fewer, you know, seats in the classroom.
Right. And I think one reason why this has been such an important issue is because school funding is based on the number of kids in each classroom. So as some schools are seeing their enrollments drop, then that's creating more financial challenges for them because they just don't have the same money they did 5-10 years ago to pay for teacher positions or resources. So the board has discussed, is there a point where a school has such small enrollment that financially it just doesn't make sense for them to operate anymore, or they're not.
And I'm thinking of like McKinley, right? Your story mentions that it lost nearly a third of its students, and that's such a storied school, incredible history.
Right, definitely. And I think the department has generally said that they'll try, if they do close schools, they'll try and start with elementary schools instead of high schools, because these high schools typically enroll more students, and they play such a major role in the community with so many schools feeding into them.
Well, it's a fascinating glimpse at what's happening in our public schools. But thank you so much, Megan.
Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate it.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's reporter Megan Tagami, who had a story about dwindling enrollment numbers in our public schools. Check out her story at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters La Piha Makahiki, a 100% ka'u blend with notes of strawberry jam, brown sugar, and sweet lime at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
We now keep the ball rolling on education with a story about a charter school on the island of Hawaii that's expanding its footprint. It's not your typical charter school. In fact, clowning around is encouraged at its Puna District campus. Morgan Langham is the executive director of Hawaii's Volcano Circus. It's a charter school that operates at the Seaview Performing Arts Center for Education, or SPACE. Expansion efforts in the past raised some eyebrows. In 2014, the State Board of Land and Natural Resources fined Hawaii Volcano Circus close to $50,000 for unauthorized land clearing, construction of housing structures, and removal of ohia timber on state lands. Langham says the founder of that circus and its then director is no longer involved in the organization. This time, planned expansion is taking place with community input and county approval. Langham spoke with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about what the unconventional school has in mind and how the community has responded. She starts by describing what the school hopes to accomplish with this expansion.
Our space facility is a beautiful Polynesian-style pavilion. It's open air. There's silks hanging from the ceiling, trapezes hanging from the ceiling. When you look into the office, there's unicycles and juggling equipment. But with our school, we need a place to be able to store computers and textbooks and all of the things that need to be locked away at the end of the day. So this teacher resource room will give us a place to put all of the books, have the library for the kids, really a step in being able to fully support the youth down here. We have around 55 kids that go to our school. Many of them unicycle, walk, and bicycle to school. We're located right inside of a neighborhood, Kalapana Seaview Estates. And without our school, parents would have to drive around 2 hours in the car to and from school because we don't have a bus system that takes them to the main campus, to the nearest school. So it's really important for families to be able to live below the Lower East Rift Zone. We're the only school that's located below the Lower Rift Zone.
And perhaps one of the only schools that I know of where kids get to school by unicycle.
Yes, we have a great circus class that the kids attend. So most of our students all can ride unicycles and juggle and do handstands and aerials.
I mean, I think that that's all very exciting, of course. I think most kids hearing this would probably be immediately jealous of all of those opportunities. But there's a comprehensive educational environment here, right? Tell us about sort of the school curriculum writ large.
It's actually a blended learning curriculum. So the parents do the core curriculum, which our school provides. So they're at home working one-on-one with their children, doing math and English, and they bring their kids to space for elective classes such as hula, Hawaiian studies, gardening, circus arts, pottery, and one-on-one teacher meetings where the teachers give the parents the work for the week that they then take home and do with their children.
You mentioned that the expansion that this organization is looking to do, it's sort of a physical expansion to create more facilities, because I guess that redounds to perhaps some of the considerations that the larger community might be considering as you look to increase the footprint of what you're doing there. If my understanding is correct, it's on agricultural land?
It is on agricultural land. We're on the 1955 lava flow, and it's actually all so there is not topsoil where we live. So it's not displacing farmland, but it is ag land. So we do have gardens and fruit trees, but we import all of our mulch and soil in order to grow the plants and the foods that we do.
What have you heard from the community so far on the plans to expand?
We have had an overwhelming amount of support from the community. We had over 185 positive testimonies of people who have been affected and been a part of our program for 30 years. We have kids, students in our school that their parents went to school at Space or were Hiccup Circus students at Space. So it's something our community has really needed. It's a really big win for our keiki and families and the future of Lower Puna.
Well, I imagine there might be some lessons learned, because I know, as you said, the school's been around for a long time, and I was reading some text that was written by Graham Ellis, who was a chairman, right? Used to be a chairman with the organization. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. And so I know in 2014, the Seaview Performing Arts Center was doing some growing and constructed some cabins that it was discovered was on state lands. There was a fine for constructing those cabins and an order to take those down. Did that experience for the organization inform how you decided to move forward here with the expansion in a different way?
It did. You know, those cabins were not affiliated with our nonprofit besides having a common person involved with both of the organizations. So that was actually a different organization, but we were tied together through Graham Ellis. We have subdivided and we are no longer part of that land where those cabins were. Yes.
I guess I wonder if that came up in any of the community feedback that you received.
That specifically wasn't expressed, but there are people who have lived in the neighborhood for 20 years and they were in relationships with Graham Ellis and they were opposed to us being able to amend our use permit and have a school. But since then, our neighborhood has changed and our largest supporters are now our closest neighbors. So the people that lived there 20 years ago and didn't want to have a community center and didn't want to have a school there, they no longer live in those homes that are directly affected by our facility.
Yeah, and as I understand it, there are, in the request that you have now in terms of the expansion, there are some revisions that were put in place that seem to address concerns that community members might have in terms of car traffic and volume of people coming in. Tell us about some of those amendments that were made to make sure that the expansion is something that takes the whole community into consideration.
Yes. So we have worked closely with our neighbors and with the planning department to make sure that we are being considerate of our neighbors. We have parking and traffic management on site and have submitted and had approval for our traffic management plan. Our events are limited to 9 p.m. curfew with a max of 50 vehicles. Those are kind of the two biggest concerns that came up with our neighbors, and the planning department helped us directly come up with plans to resolve those issues and limit the impact our facility has on our neighbors.
Well, I guess the real question is, does the 50 vehicle limit include unicycles?
It does not, which is really good news.
Well, I imagine, too, that it seems like the school's, one of the school's signature is the idea that the physical experience that a student has every day is such a big part of the learning experience. It's obvious to say with a circus school, but speak a little bit about the importance of that physical element to the learning experience for your student population.
Circus arts is really amazing. It has profound effects on youth and adults through empowerment and building bonds and trust with community members, with teammates, with the kids in your classroom, as well as a deep inner self-confidence. To be able to learn how to ride a unicycle doesn't take one day. It takes months of every day getting on that unicycle and getting a half a pedal further than you did the day before. And the benefit that a child has when they spend that time and they're so dedicated and the outcome is something that's so rewarding, they take that with them for the rest of their life. Circus arts is really amazing because circus incorporates everybody. There is a place for everyone in the circus. It's not just theater. In a circus, you have musicians, you have performers, you have, you know, people have to feed the circus. You have farmers and gardeners. A circus is really an entire family.
That was Morgan Langham talking to HBR's D.W. Gibson about plans to grow the Hawaii Volcano Circus and the expansion of its charter school in Lower Puna.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from PAR Hawaii, committed to meeting the energy needs of Hawaii and supporting community nonprofit organizations across the islands. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
You know, throughout this campaign, we've been revisiting some of our favorite conversations with national hosts that you'll recognize from Hawaii Public Radio's on-air programming. Today, we Hanahoa conversation with This American Life co-creator Ira Glass. He was here for a show at the Hawaii Theater, and he talked about what makes a story tick, and we get his thoughts on the landscape of public radio as it adapts in the age of podcasts. We spoke to him back in 2019. As we performed the sound check before the interview began, Glass recalled his first trip to Hawaii, which didn't go as well as he had hoped. He begins by describing how that experience inspired one of the very first episodes of This American Life.
I start the episode by saying the thing about Hawaii is that before you go, all anybody will say to you is, it's paradise. It's literally the word people use. You tell a friend, I'm going to Hawaii, and then it's like you watch the word enter their brain. The sensate thinking part of them goes away. Their eyes start to glaze. And then as if in a dream, like a scene from The Manchurian Candidate, they say the word. They say, it's paradise. And that's the opening of that episode.
I'm just curious because I read that you studied something called semiotics, which is the study of signs, which I didn't even know existed.
It actually really shaped my view of the world a lot. I mean, what semiotics is, it's a very pretentious body of literary theory that has all kinds of parts to it. But the part that I studied had to do with narrative. So it had to do with how stories are made. And there were books that I read in college, honestly, that really shaped my ideas about how to make a story. And so for me, it wasn't an abstract thing at all. It was very helpful. What semiotics is interested in comparison to like an English literature class, is it's interested in the question, how does a story give you pleasure? And so I remember there was a book that I read by a writer named Roland Barthes, French writer, where he basically, it's called S/Z, and he basically takes apart a short story, like a short piece of fiction, and he spends an entire book taking it apart phrase by phrase and paragraph by paragraph. And what he's interested in is not like the things you think of from English class, like what is the author's intent or what does it say about the author's time or whatever, you know, all that kind of stuff. What he's interested in is how does the story get its hooks into you and why do you keep reading? Why do you keep turning the page? Why do you keep watching a film? Like, why do you keep watching a TV show? Like all of that, like what is it that's pulling you in and pulling you forward and making you want to stick around for more. And then he also is very interested in the question of when a story's good, what is it that gives you that feeling of like, ah, that was so good. Like that was such a good episode of Secession. Like what are they doing that gives you that feeling? And when it fails to happen, what has failed to happen? And so for somebody who's interested in making stories like me, like it, I feel like it really gave me like a toolbox of moves and also of ways to understand when something isn't working, what's missing. And it was just enormously helpful.
It's like the psychology behind the story, I guess.
It's the psychology, but even psychology is like just part of it. In a way, psychology is like, it's not even as deep as that. It's like, how do you write a first paragraph so somebody wants to go to the second paragraph? And one of the things that we do on our show actually all the time, I stole from that book. And that is, Roland Barthes talks about this thing he calls the proeretic code. And all it is, it's again, very pretentious literary theory. But what it is, all it means is that when you have any sequence of actions going, like this happened, and then this next thing happened, and then this next thing happened, and then this next, any sequence of actions, no matter how banal it is, if you just get that started, people will stick around just to hear what's going to happen next. Like, that's part of the pleasure of it. It's like you just hear like, oh, this happened and this happened, this and this guy did this and he did this next. You just want to hear like, oh, you can tell that the story has a destination and you just want to find out what the destination is. And so people who have heard This American Life and also the other shows we make like Serial and S-Town, they know that like when our shows start, we don't say at the beginning, like today on our show, like I worked on All Things Considered, you know, the beginning of All Things Considered. We have a billboard where they say, today in the news, here's what's coming up in this hour, or whatever. We don't do that. In the first minute of the show, what we try to do is say, we just try to get forward motion going with the thought that that's going to pull you in and pull you forward kind of into the dream of the story more effectively than saying, here's what we're going to do. Because people don't care what you're going to do, really. They just want to be good. And so it's like, it's tricks like that that I learned from studying semiotics.
Well, your stuff is anything but highbrow.
Yes, thank you.
I mean, it's so quirky. I was trying to, I guess, wrap my head around, you know, what you do, and I've been listening to some things. I was thinking it's kind of like Alfred E. Newman meets Martha Stewart, because you just jump into something, but you have this wacky approach.
I guess. I mean, the way that I think about it is like what we're doing is we're just telling stories. You know what I mean? And sometimes the stories are sort of small and personal. And sometimes the stories are about big things like the protesters in Hong Kong and we'll go and hang out with them. Or, you know, what's happening at the U.S. border with Mexico and we'll go there. Or sometimes they're about like, you know, somebody's imaginary friend, Duck, when they were a kid. But what the stories all have in common is like, they have a plot, there's surprises, there's plot twists. You sort of come to care about somebody in the story and you just want to see what's going to happen. It's using the tools of narrative to do journalism, like the stories are true. And then a lot of it, like I think the reason why you're using the word quirky is like a lot of it really is just my taste and the taste of the other producers, like kind of whatever we think would be fun to talk about, you know, that's what we put up.
I'm just curious because you've been with public radio for so long. You know, how do you view this, you know, with younger people, you know, just listening to podcasts and just leapfrogging radio?
I think it's fine. I don't think it's bad at all. Like I'm very loyal to public radio because I've worked in public radio. But like, I think public radio will adapt. You know, public radio is still going strong. And I think that the two media are so similar. I don't know if this has been your experience since you came over from TV, but the thing I think that makes radio so different from television is radio is so much more intimate. Don't you think?
Yes, it is. At least for me, anyway, for TV, it's like, yeah, you grab someone right at the top and then you kind of fill in the story.
Yeah. And in radio, I feel like you're just much more present as a human being to the listener. Like there's something about just the intimacy of hearing somebody's voice and not seeing them. I think it makes it more intimate. And the fact is, like, that's true for the radio, but it's also true for podcasts. And like in my team, which I'll train, you know, we all made radio first. You know what? You know, we went on to do these podcasts that are huge, big podcasts, Serial and S-Town and these other shows. And basically the laws of radio apply to podcasts. So I don't think podcasts are a threat at all. If anything, it's kind of exciting because it's a lot easier to get together the money and get a little podcast going than it is to talk a radio station, an actual radio station, which either has to have a certain number of listeners or if it's a commercial station has to like sell advertising to actually get you on the air. I feel like the fact that it's such low barrier to entry to get a podcast going means that there's really some really fun and exciting stuff out there, and a lot of stuff that's kind of terrible. But in among it, like there's really some like really interesting things that people have made.
Well, that was a chat that I had with Ira Glass. He's the host and co-creator of This American Life. HPR broadcasts the show on Saturdays at noon. We spoke with Glass back in 2019. You know, and re-listening to this, I think this is one of my favorite interviews in the years that I've been here. And you can find the entire conversation with him on our website. And that's it for us today. I'm Catherine Cruz.